Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, a truly outstanding art exhibition has just arrived at the Albuquerque Museum. It spans more than 3,000 years and is titled Visions of the Hispanic World. Here to talk about it is the director of the Albuquerque Museum, Andrew Connors. Andrew Connors, welcome to the program. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you. It's so great to talk with you about this great show.
Andrew, what I'd like to do is spend most of our time on some of my favorites that I've picked out from the exhibition. But let's start with the collection as a whole. It's from the Hispanic Society of New York City. What exactly is that?
The Hispanic Society opened in the early 1900s and was founded by Archer Huntington, who was a wealthy heir of a railroad and shipping family, the Huntingtons, in New York and California. And he became entirely passionate about everything Spanish, everything about Spain itself and the Spanish diaspora, the way that Spain influenced the rest of the world. And he felt that the best way to document all that was Spanish was to look at the art, the visual culture of the nation, and the documents, the books, the history, the poetry, the recorded music, meaning transcribed music. So he really tried to bring to New York City everything that could possibly be known about Spain. And yet he was absolutely committed about not removing from Spain itself these great national treasures. So he tried to collect as much as possible works that were already outside of Spain.
So the Hispanic Society is his collection.
It started as his collection, but he decided not to name it after himself. He decided to
that
simply
alone
call
is
it
a difference.
Exactly. There was not ego there.
Right.
Mr. Huntington was all about ideas, not about himself. And so he opened this free public museum and library in 1907 or 08, I can't remember exactly. And it was a free museum far up on the island of Manhattan. And unfortunately, because of that location, it meant that it really was not well known and well visited by people. So it is this hidden gem in New York City, so much so that the current chair of the board of the Hispanic Society, Philippe de Montebello, who was the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York for 30 years.
Yeah, he's a very
years,
famous guy.
Absolutely. And yeah. He said, as chair of the board, I want to see if we can raise our visibility. And so he worked with Mitch Cotting, the director of the Hispanic Society, and got this exhibit to open at the Prado in Madrid, Spain, in April of 2017.
This exhibition that's here now.
Wow.
So that says something about the quality of this exhibition.
Well, absolutely. And the director of the Prado was very public in his praise of this exhibition and the Hispanic Society, saying that there was no museum in Spain or anywhere else in the world that could tell as comprehensive a history of Spain as the Hispanic Society in New York could.
So just a few more questions about Huntington himself, because do we have any idea what started him? I mean, he doesn't. You know, Archer Milton Huntington doesn't sound particularly Hispanic. He doesn't seem. Did he have some connection to Spain or Hispanics that we know of, or what got him going on this?
Well, the first thing, he seemed to have fallen in love with the language fairly early on. He was visiting one of his relatives who owned a sizable ranch in Texas, and he fell in love with the language of the ranch hands, of the vaqueros that worked on his family ranch. And he loved the Mexican Spanish that they spoke in Texas, and made early comments about how beautiful the language was. Then at age 12, he went with his mother to Europe. He didn't go to Spain, but he went to London, fell in love with the idea of a museum, and said, I would love to live in a museum. And he bought a book on gypsies.
And when I saw the British Museum, I felt the same way. It's an amazing thing.
Exactly. So he really loved the idea of museums. And then he bought this book on Spanish gypsies. And he took it home back to New York and read it and became completely enamored of the complexity of Spanish culture. such that before he even visited Spain, he had learned the Spanish language and begun to study Arabic because he understood, unlike most anybody else in the 19th century, just how crucial the Muslim heritage in Spain was to the advancement of that civilization.
Wow.
Really prescient individual. And it's astonishing that as a young man, before he even visited at the age of 22, he already knew the language and knew of the Islamic heritage there.
Wow, that's an incredible history. Now, was collecting Spanish or Hispanic art, was that in vogue? I mean, collectors tend to group around whatever is hot at the time. Was that hot at the time?
Well,
in terms of collecting?
Certainly the Spanish masters, Diego de Velázquez, the golden age of painters, El Greco, Velázquez, Varane, Murillo, were all very popular artists for United States collectors. But Mr. Huntington collected those artists, but much more significantly, he went back 4,000 years earlier than the Golden Age and wanted to find the origins of all aspects of Spanish culture. He did not want to create a stereotypical Spanish collection. He collected absolutely the opposite. He collected the art of Islamic Spain, of Jewish Spain, of Roman Spain, Visigothic Spain, Celt-Iberian Spain, and realized that all of these cultures coming together on the Iberian Peninsula basically created what we might have called in the United States earlier a melting pot, but basically it was a stew of all of the best civilizations that sort of wound up in southwestern Europe on the Iberian Peninsula, with African culture coming up from the south into the north, with all of the Mediterranean Sea cultures combining and mixing in Spain, such that there was this incredible richness of languages, of musical styles, of foods, all of which continue to persist in some manifestation in Spain today, such that there are, to this day, very dynamic separatist movements and movements to remove themselves from a Spanish mainstream federal government and establish their own ancient heritages, whether that's in Barcelona or whether that's the Basque culture. All of these different cultures created in Spain diversity that we never, ever expect when we think about Spain as a unified nation.
So that's like a perfect jumping off point for the first thing I selected. And the reason, and it's the Visigothic belt buckle, and I actually selected it because it was so, I was shocked to, I just don't think, when I think of Spanish art or visions of Hispanic culture, I don't think of the Visigoths.
Exactly. But quite frankly, before this object, I never thought much about the Visigoths, except they had a really cool name.
I
really didn't think anything about so many of these different cultures that were so important in early Europe. And certainly the Goths established themselves in a variety of different places around Europe, probably as the precursors to the Germans, the Germanic peoples. And yet the Visigoths established themselves in Spain around 500 current era, and basically Rome had basically dissolved in Spain at that time, and the Visigoths moved in. And one of the major capitals of Visigothic culture is the city known as Toledo, currently known as Toledo, and yet that was founded as a Roman city. And after the Visigoths basically were conquered, it was a major center of Hebrew culture, of Jewish culture, then of Islamic culture, and then was finally captured around the year 1000 by Christians. And yet all of these cultures contributed to the creation of the city of Toledo.
So another reason why I picked the belt buckle is that when I moved to New Mexico, I was stunned by all the decorative belt buckles that I saw.
Yeah.
And this is a Visigothic decorative belt buckle that you have, right?
Right, cast in bronze and astonishingly inlaid with garnet. It looks like it's glass paste or some sort of enamel, but there are, I don't know how many pieces of garnet, which is one of the hardest minerals to carve, and they're beautifully carved to fit into each one of the little cells, the little spaces of the cast bronze. And it really looks like glass. It's so translucent. And then there's a gold foil behind it to reflect the light out through the garnet. So the idea that this has survived for 1,500 years, the bronze is not in very good shape, but the garnets are in exceptional shape.
It's a very rare piece, too.
It's an astonishingly rare piece and something that, as you said, you had no idea would have any connection to Spain.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in 30 seconds.
Every day, all around the world, this centuries-old art form is thriving. Classical music is made new with fresh interpretations of the great works and with groundbreaking premieres. There's a literal world of creativity to be discovered and shared. I'm Fred Child. Join me for the best from concert halls around the globe on APM's Performance Today.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
We are back on New Mexico, People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and today we're talking about an art exhibition that has just arrived from the Prado to Albuquerque. The first stop in the United States is Albuquerque, the Albuquerque Museum. My guest here in the studio is Andrew Connors. And Andrew, I'd like to move on to another one of the things I selected. And one of the reasons I selected it, it's so beautiful, and that's the baptismal font.
Yeah. The baptismal font is not something that we tend to think of as a work of art.
No.
Or if they are, they still remain in churches. So it's astonishing that this cast ceramic, it's fired glazed ceramic.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And it survives. It was created in the 1400s and probably before 1450. And again, it's an object that probably can be traced to Toledo in Spain. And represents this astonishing flourishing of art forms brought in by various settlers and various different cultures that had all come to Spain. Certainly the community that are typically referred to as the Moors, the Islamic North Africans who moved into Spain in the 700s, brought with them sophisticated art forms, music, geometry, mathematics, astronomy, an incredible understanding of the world and analyzing of the world. And they also brought with them technologies, particularly ceramics technology that developed into the Maiolica style of Spanish ceramic. And so this tin and lead glazed baptismal font was created for the Christian church, presumably.
It's for baptisms, right?
For Christian baptisms.
Yes.
But there were not Christian ceramic artists who knew the technology as well as the Moors did, as well as the Muslims in Spain. So this was created, presumably, by Muslim ceramic artists for a Christian church, which is something that most of us would never think would happen. And yet here in the United States, it happens all the time that we work outside of our own community and we expect people outside of our community to help us to create things that we ourselves are not capable of making. And so in this case, a Catholic community, presumably Catholic, Christian of some sort, commissioned the Muslim ceramic artist to make a baptismal font.
So how do we, what makes people think that that's what happened?
Well, these ceramics were only created within the Muslim community in Spain. This was simply an art form that they had mastered. And
if you wanted something beautiful, you went to the masters.
You went to the masters, absolutely.
Right.
But what I love about it, too, is that it was created for Christian community, and yet the Muslim artists infused this Christian object with their own symbols of good luck.
Like what? And,
well, for instance, at the corners, the inside corners of each of the octagon, there is a little hand, and a little hand flanked by two eyes. And the hand in Muslim belief is the hand of Fatima. The hand of Fatima basically is a protective symbol. It protects against the evil eye.
That's the daughter of Muhammad.
Was the daughter of Muhammad, exactly. In Jewish faith, it's the hand of Miriam, who was the sister of Moses.
The same symbol.
Exactly. And right. Hamsa just means five, so it's the five fingers of the hand. And so we've got this good luck symbol from Judaism, from Islam, on a Christian object. And then, as if to seal it, as if to basically celebrate that we are the world in this baptismal font, the artisans also painted a thistle on the underside of the baptismal font. By the Middle Ages in Spain, the thistle had become a protective symbol against the plague, and the plague was certainly something that that literally plagued all of Europe.
Why would that be a protective symbol?
I'm not quite sure why it became a symbol of the plague, but I do know that the symbol had been was truly ancient in Spain. Certainly, we think of the thistle as the symbol of Scotland because it's tenacious. Perseveres. You can't get rid of it. It's tough as nails. And it is a Celtic symbol. Yeah. And the Celts settled in Spain. So
Were also in Spain.
Exactly. The bagpipe, which we tend to think of as a Scots, sometimes Irish musical instrument, also is dominant in Spain as the gaita. So it's a Spanish musical instrument as well. So the thistle on the underside of this baptismal font basically is incorporating Celtic good luck symbols as well. So the babies that were baptized in this baptismal font were getting blessings from all of these different cultures and really set off on their life having good luck. And I love that sense of celebration of diversity of cultures because that's what made Spain such a powerful country.
So having mentioned Christianity and Islam, there's another thing I picked, another exhibit, which is the Hebrew Bible, which in terms of the beauty of the work on the Bible is just stunning, and just the condition of the Bible is stunning.
Well, it is. It's astonishing to think that it was created around 1450, and the pages are in magnificent shape.
How in the world do you conserve it? To cause that to happen. I mean, it looks like it was created yesterday.
Well, first and foremost, it was created exquisitely. The best of craftspeople created the parchment and made it incredibly fine and finished it beautifully. The inks were the best inks, the most refined inks. The penmanship, the calligraphy was spectacular. So everything about this book was made to last.
A family would have commissioned the creation of this thing?
Presumably a family either commissioned it or bought it.
Or a temple would have created it?
No, it would not necessarily have been written for a synagogue or a temple because it's not a Torah. It's not the scroll form of the sacred texts. It's a book form, which would have been read individually, not read in a public place. So it is presumed that a family did commission it because you wouldn't launch into creation of an object like that unless you had a market, unless you had somebody that was willing to pay for it. But the family that then commissioned it was expelled from Spain when Spain in 1492 declared that Jews were and Muslims were no longer welcome.
I read that. How is that known?
Well, because Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand simply decreed it.
In other words, every Jewish family had to leave.
Yeah, they were either to leave or they were to convert to Catholicism. And so this family felt that they wanted to maintain their heritage, and they left to Portugal. And unfortunately, 5 years later, Portugal also expelled the Jews and Muslims. And so the family then moved to Fez in Morocco and then ultimately settled in Italy. And so the family then maintained ownership of the Bible until the 1600s when they sold it to another family. Then the Bible traveled all throughout Europe as the family moved from place to place, as translators And basically ambassadors from the, because they spoke Spanish. So this family was very prominent, although they were Jewish, so they couldn't live in Spain. And it's an astonishing object because it represents so much that pivotal point when a nation decided, we do not want you. You are different from us. Even though Jews and Muslims had been in Spain, in many cases, long before Christianity had.
It's called in the catalog illuminated. What does that mean?
Illuminated basically means illustrated. So it's not just text. They're beautiful initial letters, which is very rare for Hebrew Bibles. Uh-huh. And then there are these fully illustrated pages. And it's assumed that those pages were added while the Bible was with the family in Portugal. So in our exhibition, we have it open to one of those illuminated pages, and there you see all kinds of beasts in the borders, wonderful dragons and the double-headed eagles and peacocks and lizards, all climbing around the interlace of the border with the beautiful gold letters, gold Hebrew letters in the middle of the page.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio with me Andrew Connors. Andrew is the director of the Albuquerque Museum, and we're talking about an exhibition that has just arrived in Albuquerque. Its first stop was the Prado, and it's quite an exhibition. I do want to mention one thing specifically, and that is the Duchess of Albuquerque, the effigy of the Duchess of Albuquerque, because I think if you live in Albuquerque, you're going to be interested in seeing the Duchess of Albuquerque.
Exactly. And she was, she lived long before the Duke of Albuquerque, after which our city was named.
The 10th Duke. So, this is the first Duke.
Right? So yes, she was the wife of the first Duke. She was the second wife of the first Duke. Not that anybody's counting, but he had bad luck with his wives. He lost three of them before he died. But this is Doña Mencia Enriquez de Toledo, and she was named the Duchess of Albuquerque. This effigy was created for her memorial in the local church, the parish church. And her husband commissioned a number of these memorial, basically altars for his siblings and his wives. And this was one of those incredible objects that simply was abandoned in the 19th century, starting in the 18th century. The Spanish crown could not afford to maintain all of the churches in Spain. And so they wanted to hand them back to the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church said, we can't maintain all these churches either. So a lot of the churches were sold off to private individuals, and some of them simply fell into ruins. So in this parish church, there were these spectacular funerary monuments. And luckily, a collector in the late 19th or early 20th century realized there were some treasures in this falling down church, and they purchased these memorial effigies. And Mr. Huntington then, from that collector, purchased two of them that are in the Hispanic Society. They couldn't ship the entire wall installation. It's an altar-sized installation. So we just have the figure itself of the Duchess.
It's quite beautiful.
Carved in alabaster, and it truly is.
But, the time is whizzing by, and I don't want to not mention my very favorite thing in the exhibition, and that's Velázquez's portrait of a little girl. And, I looked at it and looked at it and looked at it, and I can't get it out of my mind. It is so alluring and so meaningful, and I'm not sure how to put into words the feeling one gets. It's just a small portrait of only the head of a, looks like a very young girl. But why don't we start with who Velázquez was?
Well, Diego de Velázquez was one of the most important painters in what is typically called the Golden Age of Spain. But he was not just a painter. He was not just a visual artist. He was a diplomat. He was a translator. He was an emissary for the Spanish king. So he truly was a man of the world, and he knew how to to convey himself in the courts of Europe. And yet he could come home and paint these unbelievable portraits of the most officious, pompous-looking individuals, such as the Count Duke of Olivares, a great portrait that we also have in the exhibition. But this portrait, I'm so glad that you feel this connection to this portrait because it's incredibly intimate. And it's for that reason that the curators at the Hispanic Society feel that it's probably a portrait of Velázquez's granddaughter.
I see.
So it is not a commissioned portrait.
It looks like it's done with such feeling.
Exactly. Yeah, you really see that family connection, that personal loving connection to a young girl. And there's no pretense to it. It's just bravura painting. The brushstrokes are so light and so masterful. It's truly astonishing. And you can tell that he was not interested in making a finished painting. He was interested in capturing her essence because her clothes are just barely sketched in. The dress that she's wearing is just hinted at, and it's all about her face and her personality and that spirit. I don't know if she's about to be a bad 8-year-old or if she is about to say something incredibly brilliant, as often
there's sort of a wry smile. I mean, I think we put a lot into it, but she's only a young girl, 6 to 8 years old. So we're putting a lot of our feelings into what we think is going on in that portrait.
But that's what a great portrait does. A great portrait pulls a lot out of us, the viewer. It's as much about the way that we perceive that individual as it is the way that the individual was themselves.
So we're nearing the end of the show, shockingly, and we've been talking about the exhibition that's presently at the Albuquerque Museum, and surprisingly, maybe that's only part one. So there's a second part. The first part will go along with the second part to March 31st. So I'm wondering if you could give us somewhat of a preview of what we will see when we go down to see part two, which comes, I think, December 22nd.
The second part of the exhibition really talks about Spain as it's devolving into something very different. Quite frankly, a modern state. A modern state where multiple voices are again beginning to be heard. And at a time when modern art was also providing humanity with a new way of seeing the world. So this exhibition sort of leads up to the modernity that led Picasso to create his great masterworks. Mr. Huntington never collected Picasso. He felt that there were enough museums that were telling that story, so he stopped collecting work in the 1920s. But you can see exactly how Picasso got his sense of independence. With masterful examples by the Impressionist painter Sorolla, two fantastic paintings by Sorolla, a John Singer Sargent painting, the American artist who was so enamored with Spain. So there are a lot of different voices that really talk about Spain becoming something different from the Spain of the Golden Age.
We are going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank today's guest, Andrew Connors, the director of the Albuquerque Museum. Thanks also to my engineer, Roman Garcia. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.